particularly what we've seen with COVID and everyone being at home, we've started this massive specialization of labor, right? So you've got top of funnel demand gen, then SDRs, then BDRs, and then, you know, handoffs to the AEs, and then expansion reps. And like, we've really micro parsed it, kind of like Adam Smith's pin factory. You know, everyone's down to their very technical thing. But if they're not operating in a system, it's just kind of a random walk.
Hi there. This is Vijay Damoji Prabhu, and you're listening to the B2B Go-To-Market Leaders podcast. The show where I go behind the scenes with top go-to-market practitioners to discuss their mindset and tactics.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of the B2B Go-To-Market Leaders podcast. This is Vijay, your host. And yes, I know that I have taken a slight break. It's been a couple of months where I've had a lot of other things, but fun things going on various fronts. But less about me. This is more about you and what advice and insights that you can get that you can apply today and next week in your go-to-market roles. So with that, I am super excited to welcome Jamie Cleghorn. Hopefully I didn't butcher your name, Jamie.
Perfectly good Scottish pronunciation there.
Yeah, so you can blame it on all the scotch that I try. So thank you for that. Yeah, so by the way, thank you for being on the show. I'm super excited and welcome once again, Jamie.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
With that, I always start with this question, which my audience love and listen to, which is, how do you define go-to-market?
Great question. It's everything that's between a value proposition and a happy customer. The precondition for go-to-market is strategy. It's having a clear sense of what are we building, who are we building it for, and why would they give you perfectly good US currency in exchange for it? And once you have that, then it immediately devolves into go-to-market. Product management, marketing, sales, post-sales success, all of those things. I think in some camps, it might actually be a bit controversial to put product into go-to-marketing or into go-to-market. And in my experience is that when you don't have product in the go-to-market consideration set in that value stream, it usually breaks down. And so getting product in there and really building a straight line from that value prop to the customer is really what you're trying to do.
Yeah, no, this is super crisp and helpful. I'm actually so glad that you highlighted the role of product in the whole go-to-market sequence. Because when I speak with quite a few folks in the go-to-market world, or even a couple of guests on the podcast, there are times where I need to remind that it's just not about marketing, it's just not about sales, it's just not about post-sales. Product plays a very important role, especially if your go-to-market is around product-led growth. You better have product front and center in those things.
That's absolutely right. I think we could all sit here and say a good product manager is going to be customer centric and they're going to be needs based. And I cannot tell you the number of organizations we walk into where we say, okay, show us the one piece of paper where you've written down crisply what the value proposition of this product is. And it's not there in many cases. Sometimes it's just they ran out of time. They were too busy getting the development sprint done or whatever it is. But without kind of that Dick Tracy decoder ring of why would a customer want this, marketing just kind of makes it up. And then sales just kind of makes it up. And then customer success gets shipped to a new deal. And the first question they say is, so what were you promised? And so towards pulling that thread back to square one around what is the promise we're making here? What is the value we're exchanging? What is it that we're doing in a need-based way? I mean, that really is bedrock, and it's actually really hard to do well. It's a short letter, hard to write a simple short letter.
This actually reminds me of the practice. I think it's promoted or emphasized at Amazon, and I'm pretty sure it's emphasized pretty much anywhere where go-to-market is a central focus area, which is, when you're embarking on a new initiative or a new product release, start with a press release, okay? Start with a press release as to why someone should care about it, why there should be so much buzz and excitement in the market, and then let's work backwards.
I love that. We'll do something similar, which is like, okay, I'm your first customer. Sell me your product. Why should I care? The answer is usually in there. It's not like they haven't thought about it. They just haven't translated it from feature to benefit, or they haven't really put themselves in the shoes of a buyer or different members of the buying committee and really thinking through the different pieces of it.
Yep, for sure. So switching gears a little bit over here and going big picture and definitely on the personal side of things, you are a successful partner at Bain, a leading strategic consulting company. It's a known brand, global brand. So tell us about your journey. What led you to the path of management consulting and what do you do at Bain today?
Yeah, I'm a born, raised, and trained data-driven marketer. My dad was a data-driven marketer and just kind of was aware of it from the youngest stages. And in some ways, it's in my DNA. His dad was an advertising and a newspaper publisher. On the other side, I've got technologists and psychologists. So this whole intersection of go-to-market using words to stimulate action and communicate has always been there. I mean, it's always sort of captivated me. And so I grew up wanting to do that and did that and did that professionally until my late 20s and then got really bored with it. I no longer wanted to have the go-to-market seat at the table, largely because I found it too constrained, honestly, and it was too much on the order-taking end of things. And so I went to Bain to be a strategist and to sort of open the aperture and think bigger and do that work. And it was great. I've loved all of that. In fact, strategy, however, got boring again, because you can only do so many market studies. You can only do so many plan briefs before it has to immediately devolve into the hard work of bringing it to market and building that innovation for real and all of those things. So I ended up back in go-to-market land. It's sort of that Einstein quote of success is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Well, the strategy is kind of the 1% and the go-to-market defined as product on down is the 99%. And most strategies aren't bad. Most companies won't sit around, most executives won't sit around and green light a bad strategy. They green light good strategies. And then it dies a death of 1,000 paper cuts on its way from product to marketing to sales and into success. And so I spend a lot of my time working with organizations to kind of clear out the pipes between strategy and success, realigning go-to-markets, accelerating go-to-markets, redesigning go-to-markets, and lead that product and IP for Bain globally, which is a lot of fun. I work in lots of industries, primarily technology, but have done, you name it, I've probably worked on it, and bring a lot of, I don't want to call it change management, but a lot of the lens of why do people change? Every consulting and engagement ends with things people need to do differently. Whether or not they do them is the difference between a book report and a result in the business. And that's not very much fun to work on book reports. So spend a lot of time really making sure that everything we do is dialed in to what's going to work with our clients, what they're excited about, what they believe in, and harnessing the energy that's existent inside their company to make the right next change, the next step on their journey, as opposed to a corrective, if you will.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I love the quote that you mentioned, right? Which is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. To be honest, I can relate to a lot of things and the conflicts that you lived through and went through for several reasons. One is when I was doing my MBA at Cornell University, as you very well know, MBA grads, they are flooded with consulting job offers. Being me and being like many other people at Ivy League schools, I was contemplating, hey, whether I should really pursue a consulting career.
We were part of that flood, probably, weren't we?
Absolutely, for sure. But then a part of me went, hey, you know what? Consulting is nice. It looks cool. It looks sexy. But for me, what gets going and why I'm excited is more of being in the weeds, that execution piece, which you just mentioned. Fast forward, post my MBA days, I have been in the industry in executing or execution capacity. And over the last couple of years, again, I flipped where I started my own boutique go-to-market consulting company, did that for a couple of years. And again, that bug bit me, which is, okay, consulting is fine, but again, it's all about execution. So now I'm back full-time at a Series B startup, leading strategy growth function, which encompasses product-led growth, mid-market enterprise growth.
Your own little growth laboratory to play in.
Exactly. Yeah. So going back to what you mentioned, right, you can come up with all the research and the strategy, but then the fun part is putting that to use or putting that into effect and seeing, as you correctly mentioned, towards the end of your little story and journey is a lot of it has to do with change management. a lot of it. And change is hard. And that's where really good, strong go-to-market leaders come into play, where they recognize that and they are empathetic. They are vulnerable and they come across as that. And they coach the different functions and stakeholders in pursuing that change.
One of the most powerful tools, I think, in that is co-creation from square one. And we can often tell if a consulting engagement is going to end in results or not, measured by how engaged the team is on the client side. If they just want to be executives and kind of get the book report every month and say thank you, that's not a great sign. But if they've got people at all levels of the organization, we're doing workshops every other day, we're trying things on, we're discarding them, we're trying the new thing. Did one of those last year and we ended in November. They rolled out a new price packaging architecture in December and January as a pilot. Drove immediate success. I was talking to the leader yesterday. Their win rates were accelerated. Their win rates are higher. Everything about it, ASPs up, mixes up. Just a great story. And that was before the full rollout. So that was picture perfect example of co-creation with a client, sort of bringing the best of our science and our tools and our experts and their domain expertise and their knowledge of how their company works, what organs are going to get rejected and which organs are going to get accepted, and sort of crafting something that slotted right in. And I'll tell you, the one trump card in all change management is success. If you can figure out how to show success early, you'll get people to change their minds pretty quickly.
This is something that I am focusing on and telling my team here in my new role is focus on the quick wins. Do little experimentations around customer acquisition, experimentations around onboarding and first user touch points and experiences, and even pricing. Do those little experiences, get the data, and then that data, yes, they might be quote-unquote failures, but it's more of a feedback loop. But once you see that early quick wins, that'll give the juice and the boost and the morale to the team to change.
Yep. What I'd add to that is for any company that go to market, it's a system. It's hundreds of people. It's lots of different sales technology, marketing technology. It's kind of like a house with 100 additions. As a manager of that, you're like, well, what should we add on next? What room should we renovate? And the art of being a good go-to-market leader is exactly what you said, which is I'm always running a bunch of experiments. And then when I see something that works, I go and remodel that kitchen or I remodel that bedroom or whatever it is. I mean, you never want to like tear down the whole house. You won't have anywhere to live. You got to make the quarter. But if you're always sort of constantly optimizing continuous improvement, it's a fun way to run a business.
Yeah, for sure. I know you alluded to this a little bit and looks like you have, and you and your team have been doing some research around how to improve the overall B2B sales and B2B go-to-market. Now is a good time for us to just deep dive into that. So do you want to walk us and the listeners through the research that you've been focusing on so far?
Yeah, I would love to. You know, it started with an insight that we had a number of years ago, which was that there was this thing called a sales play that a lot of companies were running. And we saw those really work because what they did was they were the transversal. They broke down the functional silos instead of saying product throw over the wall over the wall to marketing, marketing throw over the wall to sales throw over the wall to success. Sales play is a transversal that cuts across and is sort of that direct line from the value prop to the customer. And yet we also would run into clients and companies that were running sales plays, but to no great effect. And so we sort of had this thesis that the play was really valuable, but it was really the system around it. Somewhat similar to the work we had done with NPS, you know, Bain created the NPS score in the 90s. And we said, you know, it's not the score, it's the system. You can have the score, so what? Like, okay, you've got a score. It's like getting a credit score. Like, okay, well, I have a score. But like, what are you going to do about it? And how are you going to build the feedback loops around that? So the research we did was to look at companies that were doing it well, try to isolate those variables and say, what are the elements that actually drive above market growth and share gain? And we really boiled it down to five things. And that's what the research said. And we said, and what we found empirically through our research is that the companies that did all five of these things were almost three times as likely to outgrow the market as the companies who didn't. It was very intuitive to us and how we got there. And it was great to see the data bear it out. And we think that these are the five things that are going to define the future of go-to-market, in part because the companies that are winning and taking share are the ones that are doing it. And so they're the ones that are going to be left at the end. It all starts with a very data-driven view of where the dollars are in the market space. So most companies can tell you, hey, we've got a 20% market share. What they can't tell you is at client X or at prospect Y, what's my share in this product category? When we build that for customers, It's like turning on the lights in a dark room. And you're like, oh, here's where the money is in the market. I now have a map of where all the dollars are, both in my retention accounts and my new logo accounts, my expansion accounts. And building that and building a really robust view of that at a customer prospect level, by product level. And we had a theory that you could build that process at scale and at speed. And we've done that. And so we do that for clients now. And we call it the money map. It's a map of where all the money is in the market. And companies have different potential models, share wallet models. But having some data-driven view of that, really critical. Because without that, you're just kind of guessing, right? And I'm all for believing in the instincts of the front line. But their instincts on what the dollars are, not always spot on. The second part is this sort of factory that builds the play. And the insight there is it's really cross-functional. Sometimes we call it the iron triangle of product, sales, and marketing. If you need to get all three of those constituents together. And if the three of them together architect the play and say, you know, here's the messaging, here's the cadence of marketing actions, here's the close, and sort of make that a group effort on building that, as opposed to what we often see in companies of sales saying, well, I haven't gotten the marketing yet. And marketing saying, well, I'm waiting for the product brief. But just sort of putting them together and really embracing that agile mentality, building that play in the factory, really sort of brings it to the next level. The next piece then is kind of this advanced command center, if you will, that uses that data on customers and uses that library of sales plays and kind of does the matching, right? You can call it next best offer, or it could be a place where you have a lot of opt-in, right? So we've done this with a big technology company last year. They had a portfolio of sort of 10 legacy products and 5 new strategic products. And they use this as a way to say to the reps, pick 3 and pick 2. You can sell 3 of the old thing and you can sell 2 of the new thing, but that becomes your account plan or those 5 plays you're going to run there. That's really empowering for the reps. And it's a way to sort of shift the mix in a very constructive way for the company faster than they would just by waiting for the sales force to adopt the new thing. So that's that win room, which also then is your test and learn center. That's where you talked about those experiments. It's monitoring, it's tracking, and it's making micro adjustments. At the front line in the execution, because the play is articulated, you've got marketing and sales working in tandem a lot better. And the swing factor there was what we found is coaching. Something like 2/3 of reps wouldn't pay a dollar for an hour of their manager's time. But some reps would pay $500 for an hour of their manager's time. And that's because their managers are giving them really good coaching and they're helping them hit their number and exceed their quota and all of those things. And so really zeroing in on the coaching element there for us is the swing factor. And then the fifth is technology. Sort of getting that RevOps tech stack engineered. And it's funny, we found that the winning companies that were 3 times more likely, they had 11 pieces of sales and marketing technology. So they've architected a system. But the ones that were losing share and undergrowing the market, they had 9 pieces. So it wasn't actually about buying the tech. It was about integrating the tech, marrying it to your business process, and then really getting it in the workflows. And so all those 5 things together, that's what it takes to outgrow the market.
Got it. So if I reflect what I captured, and this is where you can correct me if I got all the right elements. First is all around data. Making sure that you're capturing the right data and even looking at the existing data that you have around which of your products, customer segments are performing well and why, and how much more room is there to grow within those customer segments or customers.
Well, at a customer level, even at a named customer, named prospect level.
There you go. So at an account level. So that's one. Second is having that magic triangle is what I would call, which is the product, marketing, and sales. If I can chime in, I would even add customer success if you are a B2B SaaS. So it's a triangle / a rectangle, depending on whichever business model you have, for sure. But I get the essence. Definitely having those, it's not operating in silos, as you said, but all of these functions working hand in hand. That's critical. That's the second piece. The third is around looking at your entire product portfolio set, both the new offers that you have as well as the existing or the legacy. Because sometimes, I mean, whatever you have right now, you can package it well. Again, okay, so I'm going to give an example, not to promote Samsung, but this is the most recent example that came where I was purchasing or pre-ordering the Samsung S22 phone, the Ultra. And the way Samsung packaged it is, yes, we'll give you a free upgrade on the memory, but at the same time, we're giving you $250 of instant credit in the Samsung store, which means now I'm buying not just the S22 Ultra, but I also got the Samsung watch, which I was not planning to, right? It's an existing product and a new product packaged together and sold. That's an example right there.
Yeah, it's a great example. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And the fourth one is around why am I missing? I get the fifth one.
Coaching.
Yes, of course. Coaching, for sure. I think this is where a lot of the go-to-market leaders have to invest in themselves, even if it means getting a coach for themselves. Because the way I look at it is a role of a leader or a manager is to ensure that their team is successful. And for that to happen, you need to coach. And for you to coach, you need to know how to, first of all, identify the growth areas and then how to teach. Yes, you may be the expert in a specific subject matter, be it pricing or packaging or selling or qualification, right? But if you can't, you're just doing half the job, not the full thing.
I think it's exactly right. And specifically in sales, most sales managers were last year's really good rep and this year's probably pretty mediocre sales manager. And so that's a pretty high turnover industry. So teaching people constantly how to coach, particularly in sales, but also throughout the go-to-market value chain, so important.
Absolutely. Then your fifth point, which is again, having the systems and the right technology to tie all these pieces.
Yeah. CRM, marketing automation, AI overlays, Cadence softwares, kind of all the bells and whistles you see out there, enablement, train, all the things that all your listeners get called on every day for a demo of this or a demo of that.
Yeah.
And there's what, 10,000 sales tech and MarTech companies out there. So there's no lack of things to buy. There's no integrated suite out there. It takes a really sophisticated RevOps or commercial ops person to say, you know what, here's our value flow. Here's our CRM. Here's our marketing. Here's where we're going to tie it together. Here's where we're going to add in a Clary or a Kong or a Chorus or an outreach, you know, sort of all the things like that. Getting that dialed in is tough. That's why RevOps leaders are in such demand right now.
No, totally. And just tying back to what I'm seeing, what I've seen at the clients when I was doing my own consulting, plus what I'm doing in my current role, is there is a tendency where a lot of people buy technology because A, they have the budget and they need to spend, or because their peers are doing that. They're not flipping and asking the question, hey, what are the insights that I need? What are the gaps that I'm not aware of that I need to know of so that I can make the right decisions for the team and the executive leadership and for the business overall to serve the customers? Ask those questions first and see if you have the right tool set, be it your MarTech, be it your sales tech or whatever, or even your BI, like a Tableau or something, and then go for that tool.
Right. I love BI. It's like business. It's not, BI is not intelligent. BI is visualization, right? Like you have to ask it intelligent questions and it can give you intelligent answers, but there's no native intelligence in BI.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. Like sales, go to market used to be pretty simple. Like here's your product catalog, here's your patch, here's your quota. Good luck. Particularly what we've seen with COVID and everyone being at home, we've started this massive specialization of labor, right? So you've got top of funnel demand gen, then SDRs, then BDRs, and then, you know, handoffs to the AEs, and then expansion reps. And like, we've really micro parsed it, kind of like Adam Smith's pin factory. You know, everyone's down to their very technical thing. But if they're not operating in a system, it's just kind of a random walk. And so what we believe is that the modern revenue leader needs to be a systems engineer, a systems designer. And it's usually not about spending more money. I mean, that's the thing. You know, you talk to a CEO and they'll say, I'm spending 10, 20% of revenue on go-to-market. Like, isn't that enough? And the answer is yes. In fact, you probably already have all the technology you need. You probably have the right headcount. You might not have the right skill profile, but they're not knit together in a way that they all work. And that's what we need to get companies to do, is to sort of figure out how do you bring all those elements together and make them work in an orchestrated, harmonized way, which is the system that we talk about, the five elements of the system. Those are the five elements to get to that orchestrated, harmonized, high-performance machine.
For sure. I'm actually glad that your team did the research and reinforced the five key foundational elements, right? If you step out, a lot of these insights are common sense, not to downplay the research or the clients out there. But somehow along the way, people lose sight of this. And that's where I'm glad that you did the research and you are reinforcing this message of all these five pillars being in place.
It's hard to see the forest when you got to chop down trees every day. That's one of the luxuries we have as consultants, is we get to come in with fresh eyes and a really good sense of what good looks like and say, you know, hey, here's how you might want to lay it out. And that can be really powerful for companies.
For sure. I'm super excited. By the way, I'm going to add your research article and research piece in the show notes. For all new listeners, you will have that in the show notes. So congratulations to you and your team there, Jamie.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a fun piece of work and it's fun to talk to clients about it.
For sure. So let's switch gears. You're actually at a very strong vantage point and a good vantage point where you can step out and see all the different client scenarios, different industries where things are working or not working when it comes to go-to-market. So from your broad breadth of experiences, it'll be ideal if you can share two stories, one a go-to-market success story and another a go-to-market failure story, because hey, behind every success, there have been a ton of failure stories, which people don't realize. So if you can share a success story and then a failure story or vice versa, it's up to you, but I'd love to listen to those.
Well, I'm going to have to like change the names to protect the innocent here. We maintain our client confidentiality. So the successes, they come in two flavors. One, I like to call them steroid shots, and they are for businesses that are doing well, and they just need like a little bit of an injection. Oftentimes, they're a victim of their own growth. They've posted 30, 40% year-over-year growth, and what got them to here just isn't breaking. They've added product complexity. They've added segments. So helping them sort, and complexity is multiplicative, right? So it's pretty easy, mono product, mono sales, mono customer, but as soon as you start to match, there's lots of failures to fall down. So we do a lot of work around packaging, pricing, which almost gets back in sort of market-led product strategy, coverage models, handoffs, or capacity planning, all of those things, kind of building the next generation of the growth machine. And those are fun projects. And those usually are with good companies, with good products that they just kind of need like a roadmap for the next leg of the growth. Those are great fun to come back to a year later and find out that they were really successful and how they did those. And those are great. The other flavor of success are these kind of epic journeys. In my own personal business, we do a lot of work with private equity. And private equity has a saying, no bad assets, just bad prices. There are plenty of companies that have really good bones in place, but have kind of lost their way in the market. Oftentimes, there's a technology transition that happens. You know, we worked with one, kind of missed the pivot to cloud, just missed it. They were public. They started shrinking. Like their top line started going backwards, negative 5% year over year. And private equity, and they got spun off and private equity bought them. We worked with them and we got them back to growth. But it was a multi-year journey to retool that whole go-to-market. You know, how do you call on cloud infrastructure providers and not enterprise data center providers, right? That was a big example. And that was product, that was sales motion, that was marketing, that was success, it was service. It was kind of everything around those. Those are high risk, by the way. A lot of things need to go right over a long sustained period of time. But, you know, the particular one I'm thinking of right now is a very successful publicly traded company that's posting sequential growth and is out there acquiring and sort of using that business we worked on as the cornerstone of something that is working. A failure, I kind of alluded to it early on, is like when those conditions for change aren't there. My least favorite consulting engagement was about 15 years ago. And we went in and built a growth strategy. And it was, we were going to do all these really cool things. And everyone was getting really excited. And we got done and they're like, this is great. And then we kind of checked back and they're like, well, we haven't really made any progress. And then we found out that they did that exact same project 2 years prior with a different consulting company. And they did that exact same project 2 years prior to that with a different consulting company. And we should not have taken the engagement because we didn't know that. And had we known, we wouldn't have. But life's too short to work on things where just the intention isn't there. Maybe that's not a failure enough failure story for you. I think there's other failures where, you know, the mind's willing and the body's weak. And so the change is there, the change gets started and it just kind of stalls out. And we've got a lot of tools to get ahead of that, but it's not, you can't always do it. Sometimes the urgency of the quarter or the other thing or cost reductions or whatever it is just means that you just can't see your way through to bright. Those are tough ones.
Yeah, for sure. So thank you for sharing those stories. Going back to the failure story that you mentioned, right? It's almost like you have the intent in this case, in your case, it was a client had the intent to figure out and do a research and understand what went wrong or what is going wrong and how to fix it, which is the first part. And that's where they engage your team. That's one. But then there's the bigger piece, which is, okay, here are the set of recommendations. Do we have the appetite and the hunger to execute? That's a big piece. It's almost like they took the first step, but then they forgot to take the next 5 steps.
Well, I'll tell you, Vijay, that's why I like working in private equity, because no is not an option. And public companies, like, it doesn't take too much for somebody to sort of say, hey, this is kind of risky. We might risk next quarter. And the reality is, if you don't change, you're just kind of on a slow slide to irrelevance, right? I mean, that's where most tech companies, you're either growing or dying, and it takes courage. Courageous leadership really is important here.
No, for sure. So let's move on to another topic, but still staying in the realm of 2022 and what you're seeing across in the various industries and clients. It's up to you, like how you want to frame it or share, Jamie, is what is top of mind for you and your team for 2022? Or what do you see as top of mind for your set of clients? And what are your recommendations when it comes to go-to-market?
Well, what's top of mind for us is this research we did, because we think it's so on point for what everyone needs. The presenting issue in this so often, well, a couple of things are top of mind. One is this just idea of technology. We've invested in the technology. We've bought all the toys. We've bought all the things, and it's not working. We're not getting the lift we want. That resonates with everyone we talk to. Alignment resonates with everyone we talk to. I think part of it's this work from home dynamic, but kind of talked about handing it off from product to marketing to sales. Like that just is not working anymore. And it's really not working when people aren't in the same office and don't go to meetings together and can't get on the whiteboard and solve it or brute force their way through it. And so was on with a COO yesterday of a big, you know, kind of a $20 billion technology company talking about marketing. The entire conversation was marketing and sales alignment. The whole conversation. Is the MQL dead? And sales would say, I don't care about MQLs. Like that's marketing grading their own homework.
SQOs, that's what I care about. And the opportunity wins.
Exactly. And so I think everyone's just tired. Like I think the world's tired. The great resignation, everyone's short-staffed, everyone's working hard, everyone's dealing with personal sickness or extended family, which has been utterly tragic. And figuring out how to get up tomorrow and go to work, much less go to work and make it better and how to do it in a new environment.
Yeah. And this is where the coaching element comes into play, going back to your study and research.
Absolutely. Because failing's okay, but failing over and over for the same reason and not getting coached, that's a frustrating place to be. Those are the things that are top of mind. And growth, like we all saw the world didn't stop for COVID. And so there's just so much capital pouring in right now, whether it's LBOs or growth equity or what have you. And so there's, you know, like sitting still is not an option. Like jogging's not an option. Running's not an option. Like everyone must be sprinting to keep up with the pace of change and expectation of the investment community. So there's just a lot. It's a dynamic situation out there.
For sure. Two points that come to my mind. One, I'll share, it's almost like an approach or a solution or a mindset thing. Going back to your point of there's a lot of capital that's flowing in, which means people, not that the intent is there, is like that, but it's almost like, hey, I got all this money, let's put it to use, versus what I emphasize in my team and broadly is, let's operate with the mindset of, we have very limited budget, let's do the experiments, we'll take 2 or 3 months to figure out what scales, which channel, and what efficiency, being very diligent when it comes to the targeting, the messaging, the call to action, the offer. Focus on the basics. Once we have that, we can then pour money and scale that, right? It's almost like a founder's mindset. Like if you go back to the early days, the founder has this mindset. Unfortunately, when the founder has to hire and expand the team to tens and hundreds and thousands of people, that mindset is lost. It's gone.
100%. I was reading something the other day. I can't remember, but it was a founder or somebody that worked in startups. And they said, doing go to market in a startup is like drilling for oil. You're going to drill a lot of dry holes and you're going to, you know, try a lot of things that fail. But boy, when you hit, like, put in a pump and pump, 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 because like scale that thing up. And I love that. I think that's bang on. And it's all about having a fast feedback loop, right? It's all about failing quickly, testing quickly, iterating.
It's all about operating in 2 weeks sprint cycles. Hey, for the next 2 weeks, let's test this segment. Okay. For the next 2 weeks, let's test this messaging. It's not that you need to go sequential. You can run multiple experiments in the same 2 week window, for sure.
When I started consulting now 17 years ago, everything was a 3 month project with 3 check-ins. Steering committee number 1, 2, and 3 at the end of month 1, 2, and 3. And now everything's in sprint mode. Everything's test, everything's minimum viable increment. How do you move it on? Adapt, 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 adapt. And I think it's better. I think it's healthier because there's a lot of time between a 4 week readout and the next 4 week readout. And readout's the wrong mentality in and of itself, right?
I mean, it's very similar to what the whole software development world went through, which is it used to be the whole waterfall model, if you go back to the software world, like 3, 6, 12 months development cycle and then release a product, sorry, your business is going to die if you're in operating that mindset. And that's why the whole DevOps phenomenon came to play. And same thing has to happen in the go-to-market space.
I think that's right. It reminds me too of a study I read about pricing models. And what they found is that the highest corporate valuations were tied with consumption-based pricing. And I think it's because you're winning your customer every time they click a button.
Exactly.
And so you can't be asleep at the switch. There's no hiding behind a 3-year contract, right?
No, for sure. It's again, going back to the whole product-led growth, you have to invest so much so that the user and the buyer sees value in the product. That's one. Second is switching from a monthly or annual to usage-based, where you have a skin in the game to ensure that the user is seeing value. Otherwise, they just pull the plug. Simple.
At the head of our utilities practice tell me that we've already solved consumption-based pricing. It's called your electric company. You get charged per kilowatt.
Yes. Excellent. Wow. We are almost up against time. It's been really fun conversation here, Jamie. So let me bring it to the finish line with a couple of questions here. I think you did allude to this, so let's skip this. You did allude to what is top of mind for you and your team, which is about how to improve go-to-market. That's a big, big one. But what resources do you lean on to really improve your skill? Is it like community? Is it like podcasts? Is it books? Is it all of the above?
This is going to sound really bad, but I can't read business books that should be pamphlets. I'll read the abstracts and that's fine. It kind of comes back to this human issue of business is not that hard. I had a CFO explain it to me once. He said, it's pretty simple. Inzies need to be bigger than outsies. I was like, okay, yeah, got it. Inzies bigger than outsies. Okay, that's good. Then you have profit left over. Everything's happy. And look, I'm being a little bit tongue in cheek. And certainly I'm out there studying and I get to have the privilege of talking to so many companies and seeing so many models and have so many great peers that are out there seeing it. So for me, it's about separating signal from noise. And there's too many things to learn. And so the one that I think is the great unifier is people. And like, why do people do what they do? And how do you get them out of the bed every morning? And how do you get them to change? Because like culture eats strategy, you know, all of this will succeed or fail quickly if you can do it in a way that resonates with people. And so that really is where most of my studying and my learning comes from outside of sort of the normal business channels.
Yeah, for sure. 100%, right? I mean, you can come up with all sorts of strategies, but if you can't empower, motivate the people, it's only going to take you so much. And it, again, goes back to the two or three things that I reinforce and which I've seen play well is if you invest in, first of all, having that intellectual humility, it's critical. It's not that you have answers for everything in this world. That's one. Second is having that curiosity. There's so much to know. I mean, you can conclude that your person and this team is thinking this way, but go and ask that question and the response will shock you. Just be curious. And the third is going back to the other pillar in your study, which is coaching. If you have intellectual humility, if you have curiosity, which clubbed with empathy, and that should drive you to become a better coach. That's where culture eats strategy any day.
I love it. And the curiosity, I had this, my mind was blown yesterday. I was talking to some friends and saying, you know, here's a situation and here's how I experienced it. They said, oh, I read it totally a different way. And I was like, wow, that is fascinating. And it just reminded me that as humans, we're just always making up stories to make sense of the data around us. And those stories might be wrong, might be right. They might be wrong too. And if you're not curious, you won't know.
Yeah. So one final question to you, Jamie, is if you were to roll back clock and time and go back to day one of your go-to-market journey, what advice would you give to the younger Jamie?
It's kind of exactly what you alluded to on the sprint mentality. It's like less living 3 months in the future, 6 months, 9 months in the future, more like what can we do tomorrow? And what can we learn from that? And how can we, I started by telling you, I went to Bain to do strategy. And I sort of thought about strategy as these big ornate edifices of intellectualdom. And they are. But you don't win with good strategy. You win with a good enough strategy and great execution. Just sort of tempering that short and long term, I think, is so powerful.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Jamie. It was insightful. I got a lot of insightful actions, and I'm sure the listeners, because this is what happens. I think I told you just before I hit the record, which is oftentimes I post the podcast episode and someone out there listens to it and comes back to me like a couple of months later saying, hey, this one piece is gold and this is what I apply, right? So thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom and stories.
Well, hopefully there's a nugget in there for somebody. Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Hi there. Thank you for listening to this episode of the B2B Go-to-Market Leaders podcast. I have all of the show notes and a full transcript on strativ.com. STRATYVE.com. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get a podcast. Leave a rating and a review. Your comments will help other go-to-market professionals find this podcast.